Iran's allies appear to show more interest in acquiring its attack drones. We talked to a drone researcher who says Russia's use of Iranian drones in Ukraine is making them more appealing.
This war has acted as a shop window for Iran, showing just how powerful its Shahed 136 and Shahed 131 loitering munitions can be.
Plus, Iran closes one of its most notorious prisons. A VOA Persian reporter tells us what might be behind the move.
Human rights activists says that Rajoy Shah prison is the place where crime against humanity have been committed.
And Iran executes 11 minority Baluch men in 3 days for alleged drug trafficking. We ask why rights activists think that charge is largely bogus. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Iran is getting a boost to its status as an international arms supplier. Tehran hosted defense ministers from Bolivia and Belarus in recent weeks to discuss military cooperation with its fellow anti-American allies. Bolivia later said it is interested in obtaining Iranian drone technology, while the U.S. research group Institute for the Study of War said it believes Belarus wants to do the same. The U.S. and Ukraine say Iranian drones have been a key weapon for Russia in the war it has waged against Ukraine since last year, something both Moscow and Tehran have denied. James Rogers is a drone warfare researcher at Cornell University's Tech Policy Institute. I asked him by phone what he thinks of the new interest in Iran's capabilities.
The demand for Iranian drones is growing at a record rate, and this is something that is happening globally. It's not just an Iranian phenomenon. Any nation that has seen itself pivot its industry towards the production of drones is seeing a massive increase in demand for those systems. So we can only need to think about Turkey or, of course, Iran as a key example, but there's also China as well that produces a large array of drone systems. And as I said to the United Nations Security Council back in August, it's at this point we're starting to worry about the current state and future state of international security. Because by our last calculations, and I've been discussing this with colleagues, we think that around 113 different nation states have access to military drone technologies or have a military drone program. And that's just the nation states. We believe that at least, at the very least, 65 non-state actor groups, violent non-state actor groups, have access to these systems as well. So this is the proliferation of violent air power globally.
What is making Iranian drones particularly appealing to countries like Bolivia and maybe even Belarus?
It's a great question, Michael, and it's one that's steeped in history. It goes back to the 1980s. So Iran, after the Shah is deposed, is left with these big-ticket high-tech items of manned air power, piloted aircraft, and big tanks. But with the withdrawal of Western support for these systems and technical support, they're pretty much useless, and any pilot that could fly away did. And so Iran is left in a very difficult situation. It quickly gets embroiled in the Iran-Iraq war, and it needs to have the capacity to be able to fight that war. And so from very early on in the early 80s, Iran turns towards these cheaper, easier to manufacture, easy to use systems that will give them a rudimentary, albeit powerful, air power capability. And this is where the drones are born. So Iran isn't new to this game. They've been developing drones for decades. Now, of course, skip to the current day, and we can see that Iranian drones are having a massive impact on the war in Ukraine, in Russia's offensive war against Ukraine. And this war has acted as a shop window for Iran, showing just how powerful its Shahed 136 and Shahed 131 loitering munitions can be in terms of fulfilling Russian military aims. And so this is exactly why other countries want to buy Iranian drones, because they believe they are effective systems and they want to get a slice of that pie.
And now apparently Russia's ally Belarus is interested in having Iranian drones produced on its territory. If you consider the latest research from the Institute for the Study of War, Belarus hasn't come out and said officially that, yes, we want Iranians to come in and start building drones here. But what do you think is the reality in terms of Belarus's relationship with Iran?
Well, there's two points to make here. First of all, there is an element of a relationship between Belarus and Iran because it's these Iranian drones that are being launched, we believe, from Belarus into Ukraine. And so that largely likely means that there are Iranian personnel either training Russian operatives who are operating out of Belarus, so they could well be in Belarus themselves, or they're stationed further back and they're in Russia and they're training from somewhere like Crimea, let's say. Either way, we can see that there's already a direct link between these Iranian military systems and Belarus. Now, one problem that Russia has had is making sure that there are secure supply lines of these Iranian drones being sent to Russia. They need hundreds, if not thousands, of them. This has got incredibly difficult because the US has put in very stringent, very strict, and heavily enforced trade embargoes on Russia from Iran. And so how do you get around this? Well, one of the options is to build a drone factory, a Shahed 136 loitering munition factory, especially for that system in Belarus. And then you can make the drones exactly where you're firing from. You're reducing that distance from the tail of your logistics to the teeth of your firepower. And that's exactly what Russia is going to want to do if it wants to make gains in the war against Ukraine.
Well, looking elsewhere, Bolivia has actually said publicly that we are interested in Iranian drones. How likely do you think it is that Bolivia will actually acquire these weapons?
Well, it is certainly a possibility. We've seen that there has been attempts by Bolivia and Venezuela to reestablish and to strengthen their connections, and between them to also reestablish and to strengthen their connections with Iran as well, as loyal allies against what they see as the imperialism of the United States and the West. And so the idea of sharing expertise or perhaps even military equipment is not beyond the realms of imagination. We've seen it with Venezuela. We saw that 12 years ago they were talking about building Iranian drone factories there. And there are some reports that say these are quite successful drone factories that are churning out systems, perhaps even the Shahed 136 loitering munitions. So there's no reason why Bolivia perhaps wouldn't or couldn't take this opportunity and to strengthen their relations with Iran. For me personally, it's a worrying prospect. We've seen the proliferation of drones across Europe. We're increasingly seeing the proliferation of drones across Africa. We saw that Iran supplied drone systems to Ethiopia when the West and the United States wouldn't get involved in their Tigray civil war against Tigray rebels. And so what we're seeing now is the even further spread of drone systems to South America.
Well, on that note, Bolivia is saying, we just want these to be able to monitor our border regions. So some seemingly innocuous purpose, but how concerning would that be for security in the region and for U.S. national security interests as well?
Well, for the United States, of course, it will be a worrying prospect and one to monitor. Like I've said before, it's Iranian operatives and Iranian training and Iranian technology that will follow these military systems into Bolivia if they are so purchased. And they'll be involved in training Bolivian officials, Bolivian officers in piloting these drone systems. But it all depends on what type of drone that they purchase. If these are exactly as Bolivia has stated, these are systems which are purely for surveillance and monitoring purposes. And we've seen this. The Bolivian Defense Minister Novillo has said that these Iranian drones will be used to monitor its border regions and provide this real-time footage for its armed forces. Then there's less worry. If these, of course, are armed systems or loitering munitions that have that extended range, and range is incredibly important. If they can fly 2,500 kilometers, then of course that brings a number of targets theoretically into range. We've seen that perhaps not so much the United States, but it's Argentina that's more worried about this. Argentina and Bolivia share a border. Argentina has demanded more information from Bolivia and increased transparency about what drone systems they want to buy, exactly for this reason. They want to know what capability is going to be bordering them. And in reaction to this, we've already seen that the seeds of drone proliferation are spreading because of this, because Argentina is looking to acquire Israeli systems. And so you can see the divides around the globes, the ideological divides are playing out through the different acquisitions of military technologies across South America.
Well, James Rogers, Executive Director of the Cornell Tech Policy Institute, on the line from Ithaca, New York. Thank you so much for joining us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thanks, Michael.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Iran's judiciary said it completed the closure of one of its main facilities for jailing dissidents on Sunday, Rajai Shah Prison in the northern city of Karaj. It said the inmates, who included dissidents held without charge following last year's nationwide protests, were relocated to Gezel Hezar Prison on Karaj's outskirts. The United States and the European Union had sanctioned Rajai Shah Prison for alleged human rights violations. For more on how we learned about the closure and the possible motivations behind it, I spoke by phone with VOA Persian reporter Saghi Lagai.
Michael, thank you for having me. So after some unofficial reports from former political prisoners and human rights activists such as Arsham Rezaei in Twitter regarding transfer some prisoners from Rajai Shahr to Gezel Hezar, a few days later, a judiciary confirmed that the prison got completely vacated and closed, and all prisoners were transferred to Gezel Hezar. An informed Inside Iran source also told me that some political prisoners of Rajai Shahr transferred to Evin prison in Tehran. All this happened by the order of head of judiciary, Mohseni Ejei. He said that Rajai Shahr prison should be closed and move outside of the city as soon as possible, and the facility should not be a prison anymore. But human rights activists says that Rajai Shahr prison, which is also known as Gohardasht, is the place where crime against humanity have been committed by those who have key roles in the Islamic Republic right now. And all these crimes are not completely known yet. And the Islamic Republic, by closing this facility, wants to eliminate evidences by closing this prison. Let me add something else, that another reason that activists mention is the anniversary of Mahsa Amini's death in custody of Morality Police is approaching, and the possibility of a new wave of protest in Iran, which the head of IRGC had warned about it. So Rajai Shahr prison is located near to a crowded residential area, and there is some concern from Islamic Republic about it.
So it seems like the Iranian authorities do have some reasons for their own interests to close Rajai Shahr prison. What can you tell our listeners about the very dark history of that facility and what happened there in the 1980s?
I can tell you that Rajai Shahr is one of the biggest, most famous and dangerous prisons in Iran. And this prison, also known for the execution of thousands of prisoners by Islamic Republic in the last four decades. And about mass executions, I can tell you that that happened for political prisoners mostly in July and August 1988, ordered by Ruhollah Khomeini, former supreme leader of Islamic Republic, and carried out by officials. That mass executions started from Rajoy Shah prison, reportedly, and continued at least in more than 30 cities in Iran. And the number of killed people was reported between 1,000 to 3,000.
Now that that prison is closed, the detainees have been transferred to other facilities, as you mentioned. What do we know about where they have been sent to? What is going to happen to them?
Michael, it's not completely clear because as official reports, they transferred to Qizil Hisar prison, which the Alborz province governor says also will be closed.
So they're going to have to be moved again.
Yeah, that's correct. And let me tell you something that human rights activist and former prisoner of Rajoy Shahr, who is familiar with Qizil Hisar's environment too, told me that prisoners were shocked because of this new situation. He said that they had tried to get used to their previous situation, but this transition is like exile for them. They also lost their own stuff like fridge, TV, or their books that they had bought them with lots of money in Rajoy Shahr prison. So they lost every stuff of them now.
Well, it does seem like those detainees are going through further hardship and more uncertainty at this time. Saghi Lagai, reporter for VOA's Persian service, speaking to us on the line from the Washington, D.C. area. It's great to have you on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you, Michael.
An Oslo, Norway-based rights group says Iran has carried out a rapid series of executions of 11 ethnic minority Baluch men for alleged drug trafficking. The Iran Human Rights Group said the executions of 9 Iranian Baluchis and 2 Afghan Baluchis happened in secret from July 30th to August 1st. It said all but one of the men were executed at prisons in Sistan, Baluchistan province, home to Iran's impoverished Baluch minority that adheres to the Sunni branch of Islam rather than Iran's dominant Shiite branch. Saba Bandoui is a Geneva-based representative of the Baluchistan Human Rights Group and a native of Sistan Baluchistan province. I asked her in a phone call why she believes many Baluchis accused of drug trafficking are falsely charged.
Well, that's a very good question, and it's quite complex to understand. But we can start from here that the geographical location of Baluchistan is in the southeastern region of Iran. It borders Pakistan and Afghanistan, and we know that Afghanistan is the world leader in terms of exporting opium. And the whole trafficking that takes place in the borders, the IRGC, we know, is in charge of the import-export of these regions.
That's the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the Iranian regime is behind all of this. It's a protection mechanism for the Iranian regime. So they are in charge and they want to be in total control. And when we have a regime that has created such a state of poverty in Baluchistan, people are desperate. They need to feed their family. They need to eat. So what happens is that some people, when there is a lack of job opportunities, a lack of schools, education, they have no other choice but to fall into this import-export, very dangerous jobs that are taking place, whether it be fuel transportation or falling into the drug trafficking system. It's a survival mechanism. It's the only thing they have. Nobody wants to fall into this or wants to export and import fuel. It's a very dangerous job. A family member doesn't know if the husband or the father is coming back the next day. That's how dangerous it is. We know that the rate of death in these kind of work, it's extremely high. So unfortunately, people have no choice. And yet the regime knows this and it's intentionally created this situation. They can then use this excuse of drug trafficking, whether if someone is directly linked or not. But it's kind of known that Baluchistan equals drug trafficking or Baluch person equals a drug trafficker, which is a completely wrong impression.
Well, I was just going to ask, is there any way of telling what proportion of the Baluchis who are
tried and convicted and then executed of drug trafficking offenses are actually involved in that kind of activity, even if they are forced into it? And what proportion is sort of framed or falsely charged or accused? Is there any way of telling?
Absolutely. So from my research, what we found out is that it's about 1% are actual legitimate drug cases. So about 99% who are given this label of being involved in drug trafficking are absolutely not linked or maybe indirectly linked, but are used as an excuse. And then we know that these people then face execution and extreme forms of violations, human rights violations in prison, into forms of torture that are unbelievable and unimaginable. We do know from recent UN reports that about 30% of executions belong to the Baluch community within Iran, and only about 4% of the whole population is actually Baluch. So we can see how the Baluch community is actually targeted and disproportionately targeted, we can say.
Can you give our listeners a sense of why Iran would push essentially fake drug trafficking charges on about 99%, as you say, of the individuals who are prosecuted for this offense? I mean, are those people involved in some kind of protest activity and drug trafficking is just a pretext to put them in prison or maybe even execute them? What's going on here?
We can say that, I mean, there are different angles to this. There could be people who are just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, so completely innocent, and are then just taken into prison, interrogated, and then sent into the cells. They could be family members. They're used as bait sometimes. We saw recently a human rights activist whose son and brother were taken in, completely innocent, never involved in any form of demonstration or any form of human rights work at all, were taken in. They were actually used as bait to kind of blackmail her from actually continuing her human rights work. So there are a number of reasons. But ultimately, it wants to instill fear. It does not want the Baluch people to have power. Baluchistan is an extremely rich area in terms of natural resources, gas, oil, gold even. So if it's in the hands of the Baluch people, the government cannot then fulfill its own economic needs. So it's a regime that is selfish in terms of thinking about its own needs, does not care about the people, Baluch people in this case, or even Kurdish people, we can say. And it's using religion to create hate and giving the wrong impression within Iran. So we can see that people within Iran, you have the kind of the main centralized Iran that has a very wrong impression of Baluch people, that they are drug smugglers, that they are uneducated, that they are bad people, basically. And this is the wrong impression that the media within Iran is trying to create, this kind of hate towards minorities, ethnic minorities, because the voices are not heard. So if a Baluch person is executed, we don't even see this on national, international media. If it was someone from central Iran that was executed, it would be all over the news. So it's a tactic, and the regime knows that it can get away with it.
Looking ahead, how do you think these executions are going to affect sort of culture of weekly protests that we've seen in places like Zahedan over the past year? Do you think it's going to reduce the turnout at these kinds of protests because of people just being afraid?
So we can say that the regime is desperately trying to scare people. It does not want people on the streets. It does not want people to raise their voice. And yet what it does not see is that through these kind of executions, direct executions or killing indirectly by, for example, giving arms to young people who then start creating issues internally within Baluchistan and other regions and killing each other, that it is actually creating even more turmoil. And well, we can say that people are getting even more angry and are coming to a point where, I mean, the Baluch people are risking everything. And in Baluchistan, Zahedan, we can see that almost every Friday they've been hitting the streets and raising their voice since the death of Mahsa Jina Amini. And they've got nothing else to lose. They say, we have nothing else to lose but our lives. They say, we've had enough. There's no point in living if we cannot have our basic human rights. And what the regime is doing is firing the people up even more by these mass executions and killings of innocent people, even women and children, which has happened in the past.
Well, let's keep an eye on the situation in that province. Saba Bandoui, representative for the Balochistan Human Rights Group, joining us on the line from Geneva. Nice to have you on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you so much.
That's all for this week's show. You can find more episodes on Apple and Google Podcasts. I'm Michael Lippin. We'll have another Flashpoint Iran for you next week.